Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 1.
In 1835, a Danish university student recorded his thoughts in his journal.
What I really need is to get clear about what I must do, not what I must know, except insofar as knowledge must precede every act. What matters is to find a purpose to see what it really is that God wills that I should do. The crucial thing is to find the truth which is truth for me, to find the idea for which I am to live and die. This is what I need to lead a completely human life and not merely one of knowledge, so that I could base the developments of my thought not on something called objective, something which in any case is not my own, but upon something which is bound up with the deepest roots of my existence, to which I cling fast even though the whole world may collapse. This is what I need, and this is what I strive for.
The 22-year-old Søren Kierkegaard was contemplating his future while visiting Galea, Denmark, in the summer of 1835. He'd left the bustle and distraction of Copenhagen for this sleepy fishing village on the North Cape of Zealand. Here he took the opportunity to think about his hitherto directionless life. Eventually, he found the purpose for which he was to live and die in his writing. He was to produce a diverse collection of books, discourses, and pamphlets that earned for him the title of the Father of Existentialism. The unifying thread of all those writings, the underlying conviction holding them together, is precisely that expressed in his journal entry. Truth is something we must live, not simply something to consider and discuss. This emphasis on actual human existence is one of the few persistent themes of existentialism, a philosophical category broad enough to include not only a Christian like Kierkegaard, but also such avowed atheists as Friedrich Nietzsche and Jean-Paul Sartre. Kierkegaard's belief that truth isn't prepackaged in books led him to a quite distinctive kind of writing. His books are always one half of a dialogue. We're invited, enticed, prodded to get involved, to supply the other half. We come to know Kierkegaard in the way we know someone who's always asking impertinent questions, playing tricks, laying traps, challenging us to be honest and thoughtful. Søren Orbia Kierkegaard was born in Copenhagen on the 5th of May, 1813. He was the youngest child of a large family. His father, Michael Pedersen Kierkegaard, was a well-to-do retired wool merchant. His mother, born Anne Sørendatter Lund, had been a servant of the Kierkegaard family, and Søren's father had married her shortly after the death of his first wife. Both parents were of solid West Jutland peasant stock. There's more than a little of the hard, dark West Danish character in Kierkegaard, even though he lived his entire life in Copenhagen on the extreme eastern edge of the country. As a young man, he traveled to his ancestral home near the North Sea, and there he suggested that the very landscape of Jutland predisposes its inhabitants to their distinctive outlook.
The heath must be particularly fitted to develop strong minds. Here, everything lies naked and unveiled before God. And here is no place for many distractions, the many nooks and crannies wherein consciousness can hide, and from which seriousness so often has trouble in recovering the dispersed thoughts. Here, consciousness must definitely and precisely hedge itself in. Truly, here upon the heath, one may well say, whither shall I flee from God's presence?
This naked self-consciousness, this spirit of unimpeded self-examination, is just what Kierkegaard set out to foster in his readers. There's hardly any mention of Søren's mother in his voluminous writings, but his father was one of the major influences in his life. Already 57 when Søren was born, the stern and melancholy old man deprived his youngest son of anything like a normal childhood. He sent the small, sickly boy to school in odd, old-fashioned woolen clothes, which resembled those given to poor children by charities. When school was out, he refused to allow Søren out of the family's large, old house in the heart of Copenhagen. More positively, Søren's father gave him his first lessons in philosophical argument and poetic imagination. They may have been the most important lessons he ever received. Kierkegaard would later weave argument and poetry into the distinctive style he called dialectical lyric. As Kierkegaard put it,
"My father combined an irresistible dialectic with an omnipotent imagination."
Despite a lack of formal education, Michael Pedersen Kierkegaard was widely read in philosophy and theology. He loved to discuss these subjects with visitors to his home. These visitors included some of the brightest minds of the day, notably the Bishop of Copenhagen, J.P. Minster. But the elder Kierkegaard could more than hold his own in the discussions that followed. In a later book, Søren offers a thinly fictionalized account of these discussions from the viewpoint of a young listener named Johannes.
Whenever his father on occasion engaged in an argument with someone else, Johannes was all ears. All the more so because everything proceeded with an almost festive formality. His father always let his opponent say everything he had to say, and as a precaution, always asked him if he had anything more to say before he began his response. Then came the pause. His father's response followed, and, look, in a twinkling, everything was changed. How it happened remained a riddle to Johannes, but his soul delighted in this drama. The opponent summed up his argument, and Johannes could almost hear his heart beating. So impatiently did he wait to see what would happen. It did happen. In an instant, everything was turned upside down. The explicable was made inexplicable, the certain doubtful, the opposite was made obvious.
In the same thinly veiled autobiographical sketch, we learn how Kierkegaard's father gave him a similarly powerful introduction to the life of imagination.
His father was a very strict man, seemingly dry and prosaic, but underneath this rough homespun cloak, he concealed a glowing imagination that not even his advanced age managed to dim. When at times Johannes asked permission to go out, his request was usually refused. But occasionally, his father, by way of compensation, offered to take his hand and go for a walk up and down on the floor. At first glance, this was a poor substitute. And yet, like the rough homespun coat, it concealed something altogether different. The offer was accepted, and it was left entirely up to Johannes to decide where they should go for a walk. They walked through the city gate to the country palace nearby, or to the seashore, or about the streets, according to Johannes' wishes, for his father was capable of everything. While they walked up and down the floor, his father would tell everything they saw. They greeted the passers-by. The carriages rumbled past, drowning out his father's voice. The pastry woman's fruits were more tempting than ever. Whatever was familiar to Johannes, his father delineated so exactly, so vividly, so directly and on the spot, down to the most trifling detail, and so minutely and graphically whatever was unfamiliar to him, that after a half hour's walk with his father, he was as overwhelmed and weary as if he had been out a whole day.
These exercises in argument and imagination were clearly important to Kierkegaard's development, yet his most important inheritance was undoubtedly a deeply felt Christian faith. The elder Kierkegaard was a member of the Moravian Brotherhood, a pietistic group, and he participated in regular Lutheran services. Søren received an especially stern version of Christianity, which he described in another autobiographical section of his writings.
Think then of a child, and give this child delight by showing it some of those pictures one buys on the stalls, which are trivial artistically, but so dear to children. This one here on the snorting steed, with a tossing feather in his hat, this is the emperor, the one and only Napoleon. This one here is dressed as a huntsman. He stands leaning upon his bow and gazes straight before him with glance so piercing. That is William Tell. And thus you show the child many pictures to the child's unspeakable delight. Then you come to one which intentionally was laid among the others. It represents a man crucified. The child will not at once nor quite directly understand this picture, and will ask what it means. why he hangs like that on a tree. So you explain to the child that this is a cross, and that to hang on it means to be crucified, and that in that land crucifixion was not only the most painful death penalty, but was also an ignominious mode of execution employed only for the grossest malefactors. With the curiosity children always have, the child will no doubt ask, "Who is it? What did he do? Tell me." Then tell the child that this crucified man was the most loving person that ever lived. Tell him that he was love, that he came to the world out of love, took upon him the form of a humble servant. Then tell the child what befell him in life, how one of the few that were close to him betrayed him, that the other few denied him, and all the rest scoffed at and derided him, until at last they nailed him to the cross, as the picture shows.
Here Kierkegaard presents this method of religious instruction as a legitimate way to correct the trivialized religious life of the day. But he knew from his own case that such a traumatic introduction to Christianity exacted a terrible psychological price.
As a child, I was sternly and seriously brought up in Christianity. Humanly speaking, it was a crazy upbringing. Already in my earliest childhood, I broke under the grave impression which the melancholy old man who laid it upon me himself sank under. A child, what a crazy thing! Travestied as an old man. Frightful. What wonder, then, that there were times when Christianity appeared to me the most inhuman cruelty.
Kierkegaard grew into early manhood deeply attached both to his father and to the Christian faith. He entered the University of Copenhagen in 1830, following his eldest brother's footsteps and his father's wishes by entering a course of theological training. Within several years, however, Kierkegaard had abandoned his pastoral plans and his home, and very nearly his faith, because of what he called the Great Earthquake. While this so-called earthquake is wrapped in mystery, it appears to involve a confession by Kierkegaard's father to some great sin. This confession was wrung from the old man by the deaths of his wife and three of his children within a two-year period. He was convinced that God was punishing him for his sins by obliterating his family. So on Søren's 22nd birthday, his father told him to be prepared to die shortly for the sins of the father. What caused the old man to expect such divine wrath? It seems that when he was 11, Michael Pedersen Kierkegaard had been left to tend sheep on the Jutland heath through the fierce winter. A single journal entry, later recorded by his son, is our only indication of what happened.
The dreadful case of a man who, when he was a little boy, suffered from hardship, was hungry, benumbed by the cold, stood on a hummock and cursed God. The man was not able to forget this when he was 82 years old.
Very shortly after his act of despair and defiance, an uncle arrived to whisk the boy off to Copenhagen to set him up in the wool business. Here Michael Kierkegaard was to make his fortune. This material success was seen in retrospect by the old man as part of his punishment. He'd received the worldly wealth and comfort he had cursed God for lacking, only to have it turned to dust and ashes as he was deprived of all that was really dear to him. The father's horrible guilt may also have had a sexual origin. Less than a year after the death of his first wife, Kierkegaard's father married a serving girl who would later be Kierkegaard's mother. The new bride was a new mother within 2 months, giving birth to Kierkegaard's oldest brother, Peter. Whether it was one or both of these sins that the father confessed, Søren was shattered. He moved out of the house, quit his theological studies, and threw himself into the wild life of the theater, cafe, and salon. Outwardly, Kierkegaard was the new and brilliant wit in the Copenhagen scene. Inwardly, he was in the darkest of despairs, on the verge of suicide. Kierkegaard had a ready wit. As a youth, he'd been nicknamed the Fork for his sharpness. His wit opened doors to the artistic and bohemian elite of Copenhagen. He was a frequent visitor in the home of the Heibergs, the first family of Danish theater. He regularly associated with a circle of young writers, which included Hans Christian Andersen. Among these associates, however, were a number of less than savory characters with whom Kierkegaard drank heavily and feasted lavishly. During this period, Kierkegaard played and dressed the part of a dandy, running up considerable bills in the process. His father had to pay them. But among the bills from the cafes, caterers, tailors, and haberdashers, there were sizable bills from the bookstores of Copenhagen. In abandoning his theological studies, Kierkegaard had in no way given up on the life of the mind. If anything, his despair lent a sort of demonic intensity to his redirected studies.
Inwardly, rent asunder as I was, without any prospect of leading a happy earthly life, that all might go well with me and I should live long in the land, without any hope of a happy and snug future, what wonder that in hopeless despair I grasped solely at the intellectual side of man's nature and clung to it, so that the thought of my not inconsiderable gifts of mind was my only consolation, the idea my only joy, and that men were to me indifferent.
In particular, Kierkegaard's intellectual endeavors in this period focused on Don Juan, Faust, and Ahasuerus, the wandering Jew. All of these were legendary figures from the Middle Ages who together represented, as Kierkegaard put it,
life outside of religion in its three typical aspects: sensuality, doubt, and despair.
In these figures, Kierkegaard saw symbolic expressions of his own condition. His intensified intellectual life thus followed his earlier resolution to seek the truth that is truth for him. Kierkegaard became increasingly self-conscious about his life of witty despair and elegant dissolution. He became all the more dissatisfied with the direction his life had taken. So he set out to retrace his steps and reconcile himself with his father and his father's faith. But just then, he had a religious experience of major importance. A journal entry from the period reads simply,
"The 19th of May, 1838, 10:30 a.m. An indescribable joy."
Kierkegaard seems to have had an experience that relieved his despair. He accepted the possibility of divine forgiveness. Shortly after this experience, his father died. Kierkegaard threw himself back into his theological studies, completing them very quickly with high honors. Perhaps he wanted to comply with his father's wish that he become a pastor. But more importantly, he wanted to ready himself to take a pastoral position. With a secure job, he would be able to marry. Søren had fallen in love with Regina Olsen. The story of Søren and Regina ranks with the very best tragic love stories. Kierkegaard fell in love with Regina when she was just 15. He quietly bided his time till she was old enough to marry. In a journal entry written a decade later and entitled "My Relation to Her," Kierkegaard tells the sad tale of their engagement.
"In the summer of 1840, I took the official examination in theology. Then straightway, I made a visit to my father's birthplace in Jutland, and perhaps, at that time, was already fishing for her a bit. For example, by lending her books and requiring her in a particular book to read a definite passage. I returned in August. The period from August 9 till into September may in a stricter sense be said to be the period in which I approached her. On September 8, I started out from home with a resolute intention of deciding the whole thing. We met on the street just outside of her house. She said there was no one at home. I was audacious enough to understand this as an invitation, as just the opportunity I wanted. I went up with her. There we stood alone in the sitting room. I begged her to play a little piece on the piano for me, as she did at other times. But that wasn't a success. Then suddenly I take the music book, shut it, not without some violence, throw it down on the piano and say, 'Ah, what do I care about music? It is you I have been seeking for 2 years.' She remained silent. For the rest, I had done nothing to beguile her. I had even warned her against myself, against my melancholy. Finally, I left. for I was fearful lest someone might come and find us two together and see her so disturbed. I went directly to her father, the counselor. He said neither yes nor no, but nevertheless he was willing enough. I asked for an opportunity to talk with her. I got it for September 10 in the afternoon. I said not a single word to beguile her. She said yes.
Immediately after Regina accepted his proposal, Kierkegaard was overwhelmed with foreboding. He sensed he'd made a mistake. Whether a self-fulfilling prophecy or not, his premonition turned out to be all too accurate. He was too melancholy, too plagued with guilt, too much a loner, and in the final analysis, too devoted to his writing to be married. Kierkegaard saw his writing as a religious duty. He saw himself as a religious exception, forbidden to marry. After several months, he broke off the engagement. The previously retiring Regina fought, in Kierkegaard's words, like a lioness to hold him. On one occasion, she came alone to his apartment, a daring act for a single woman of that day, to implore him in the name of his dead father not to break off the engagement. Her efforts were in vain. Finally, she gave up. In order to save his beloved's reputation, Kierkegaard set about a campaign of deception. He presented himself as a debauchee so that all Copenhagen would believe she'd thrown him over.
To get out of the situation as a scoundrel of the first water if possible, was the only thing there was to be done in order to work her loose and get her underway for a marriage. I passed the night weeping in my bed. But in the daytime I was, as usual, more flippant and witty than usual. That was necessary.
In keeping with his strategy, Kierkegaard made a point of going to the theater immediately after his meeting with Regina to end their engagement officially. When he wasn't weeping or acting the part of the scoundrel, Kierkegaard was writing. He'd slip out of the theater as soon as he'd made himself seen, rushing back to his pen and paper. Ironically, the tragedy of his broken engagement liberated his poetic abilities. From this point on, his life was his writing. He continued to love Regina to his death, dedicating many of his books to her. These dedications didn't mention her by name, but she knew what he meant, with the imprint that read, "To that solitary individual."
This is the end of part one. Please download part two to continue.